Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. The New York Times Review called the latest novel from New York-based author Victor Laval enthralling, and we agree, which is why we selected it for our May Get Lit with All of It book club. The novel is titled Lone Women. The story takes place in 1915. A young black woman named Adelaide is fleeing her family farm in California. Something terrible has happened there, and she needs to leave it behind. She brings very little with her, except for an exceptionally heavy steamer trunk, which she keeps locked at all times. Adelaide gets a plot of land in Montana as part of a new program designed to promote agriculture in the area. All she has to do is turn the land into a viable farm, and it's hers. But Adelaide is very isolated on the homestead as a black woman alone in the majority white town of Big Sandy, Montana. And if the powers within her steamer trunk become unleashed, Adelaide's new start and her very life could be threatened. In a starred review, Kirkus says the novel is, quote, a winning blend of brains and occasionally violent thrills. Victor Laval joined us for our in-person Get Lit with All of It book club event at the New York Public Library earlier this week at the SNFL Rooftop Event Center. It was great to see everyone in person. I began my conversation with Victor by asking how he got the idea to write a book set in Montana.
I was in Montana because I was doing an event at the University of Montana. And what I tend to do when I'm in a place where I think I probably won't be back again, I try to buy a book of local history so that later I can read about the place where I was, because it's pretty rare that these visits last long enough to actually get to know the town or the city or whatever it might be. So I was in their bookstore, in their local history section, and this one book in particular came across my views called Montana Women Homesteaders, A Field of One's Own, and it was just about single women homesteaders. And the first question I had was, I didn't know those existed. What is that? Mm-hmm. Because I'd assumed that homesteaders were just what I had seen in TV and movies. It was a white dude, the end. or sometimes yeah. It was a white family, and there was a, you know, maybe more of a Laura Ingalls Wilder kind of mm-hmm. Little House on the Prairie thing. But even there, we all know Dad was the main character, right? So that's what I thought homesteading was. But as I read this book, I discovered that the rules of the time allowed for single women or widows to claim land on their own, and that in fact the federal government was so desperate to have this land, for lack of better terms, colonized, mm-hmm. That they even made it so that it wasn't only white women who could claim this land. Black women could claim the land. Latinas could claim the land. Chinese women could not, even though they were a large population there. They were the group who was, Chinese were the people who were the most openly legally segregated or excluded at that time. And I just couldn't believe, and then there was, of course, the native populations, mm-hmm. and they at the time could not claim any land because they were being pushed onto reservations. But all of this was so much more complicated than my picture of the time. And so my next thought was like, well, I'm just some ignorant kid from Queens. I don't know anything about Montana history. Maybe everyone here knows all of this already. And so I asked these folks who I had met at the University of Montana, people who had been raised in the state. And I said, what do you know about the lone women? And they, to a person, they all said, what's a lone woman? Hmm. And so that's when I said, oh, maybe it's not just me. Maybe I can tell a story.
We asked our book club members, we hold a book club on Instagram in between these lab events, how many people had been to Montana and mm-hmm. what they remembered about it. And one person said, warm hospitality of the Blackfeet Nation and the beauty of Glacier National Park. Mm-hmm. What was it about the physicality of Montana that inspired you?
Well, I ended up on my... So I... Many years ago, I had a visiting writer job at Mills College in Oakland, California, and I was there for 2 years. And while I was there, I bought my first car that I ever owned, an Acura Legend. I was so proud of myself. Right? But it had no air conditioning. And so at the end of my second year, I had to drive back to New York. And it was May going into June, so I could either drive south across the country with no air conditioning, or I could drive north across the country. So, and I had a cat, an old cat. So,
so we went north. Better and better.
Yeah. So we went north across the country. I went along Route 2, and because of that, I went through Montana. I hit Glacier National Park. I saw Crater Lake and fell in love with it. But also, as I was driving across that route, all along the path, you'd see abandoned farmhouse, a fallen over silo, this or that. And it started getting into my head, like, where did those people go, right? Those places look like half haunted houses, half historical relics. And so at that time, I was not at all thinking about writing this book. I was just I just fell in love with that landscape.
Yeah.
But years later, when I read the history book, I said, oh, that place. Mm. Oh, yeah. I want to write about that place because I still remember it and I still love it.
What is a small detail from your research that made a big difference?
Well, one of the ones that was a lot of fun was finding out. So one of the ways I did research was that I found this. The local paper was called the Bear Mountain Gazette. I think. And online, they have every weekly issue starting in like 1909 going up to maybe 1920-something. Mm-hmm. And so for a year or two, I just read every week's issue from 1911 on.
Wow.
Just trying to, because in that way, rather than getting what a history book gets into, which is the big movements of this or that, and World War I is starting across the sea and all that, here I get to see what people cared about little by little. And one of the things that popped out at me was the absolute... how much they despised the new catalog system that was getting people to buy their goods through the mail rather than from local store owners. And they were really like, don't buy from the catalogs. You got to buy from home. And I was really like, oh, I think I understand this issue.
I literally put in my book a little LOL on this part that says, support local businesses, not some scoundrel with a warehouse out in the state of Washington.
Yes. I mean, they didn't pinpoint Washington, but I thought for the modern reader, I would make it more specific.
So the book starts, well, before I start with the beginning of the book, Big Sandy is a real place, though.
It is. So I apologized to the people of Big Sandy in the back of the book, and I said to everybody, please don't. Nobody in Big Sandy tried to kill all the lone women or anything like that. But, you know, in a weird way, I learned this lesson. A previous book of mine called Big Machine took place in Oakland, California. Mm-hmm. I wanted to write about my time there. But one of the things I did was I changed Oakland to the city of Garland, California, right? Just because in that book I have homeless people blowing up the East Bay Bridge. Mm-hmm. I have all these terrible things happening. And I thought people might take this the wrong way. But then when I did events in Oakland, people were like, you should have blown up Oakland. Why didn't you say it was Oakland? And they really wanted to claim all that, right? And so this time around, I said, I'm not gonna pretend it's a different place. It's just going to be a place that just fits what I needed. And then in the back, I'll make clear, you know, Big Sandy itself should not be blamed.
Have you heard from anybody from Big Sandy?
So far, nothing. Okay. But, you know, maybe it hasn't made it across their radar yet.
You start the book with a bang, Adelaide burning down her house, the body of her parents inside. We're not clear yet what happened to them and what Adelaide's role is in their deaths. Why did you want to start this way?
Well, certainly I feel like, you know, they often say start a story at the moment when it becomes most urgent. I figured this was a really urgent moment. And also I thought there was some fun in playing with the reader's perspective, like, should I hope that Adelaide gets away with this? Or should I think that she's an awful person and a murderer of her parents? And I wanted that ambiguity, to start right at the beginning, because on some level, that's how Adelaide feels about herself. Mm. She's not sure if she's the hero or the villain of her family story.
This is the opening line of the novel Lone Women. There are two kinds of people in this world, those who live with shame and those who die from it. Was this always the first line?
No, that can't. Usually, I think almost without fail, the beginning of my book is always the last thing that I write. I mean, I have a beginning in the early drafts, mm-hmm. but it stinks. and I have to learn the whole book before I can understand what's the place to begin. Because before that, I'm just sort of casting around. I wrote the whole book before I understood that deep down, the point of the book was like shame, family secrets, and how people deal with them. And so then, like really almost at the very end, I came up with that opening line. Felt like, okay, this will set things up.
One thing Adelaide's mother told her, and it keeps repeating over and over again, is a woman is a mule. So first of all, is that a reference to Zora Neale Hurston?
Absolutely,
okay.
Yes.
Their eyes are watching God, just wanted to make sure. What does her mom mean by this?
Well, so it was a reference to Zora Neale Hurston for sure, but it was also a version of something my grandmother felt and said without reservation, which was that she would... So I was raised by my grandmother and then my mother, and then there was my sister and I. And my grandmother was just a super grim person. She just was, mm-hmm. you know. I still remember one of my favorite stories about my grandmother that tells you about who she was is like maybe when I was like 6 or 7, I'm sitting with her and I say, Grandma, you know, I hope you live to be 100. And she says, don't curse me. I don't want to live that long, please. And it really like threw me off. But mm-hmm. at the same time, I was just like, all right, that's my grandma. She's got an idea of this is enough.
Yeah.
So that way of talking was really normal to her. Mm-hmm. And her her own life had shown her again and again that as the woman who was the matriarch of the family, she would clean up a lot of other people's messes. Mm. She would carry a lot of other people's weight. And there was no respite from that. And so she took a sort of fatalistic view about the reality of the burden of being the woman in a family. And so I would hear her often telling that to my mother, right? And my mother hated it. My mother did not believe that. Hmm. My mother wanted nothing to do with that. And yet at the same time, she moved my grandmother in with us and became her caretaker. And as far as she was concerned, my mom said like the greatest relationship of her life was her and her mother. And she was so happy that that's the person who she lived most of her life with. My grandmother was a downer. She just was. But she was also unbelievably resilient.
Yeah.
And she did do the work. You know, like you could rely on her. It's just that she wasn't going to be like, I'm so happy to carry everyone's weight. She would be like, this sucks, but all right.
We learn that Adelaide loves to read, and there's one book she particularly loves, The Tenant of Wildfell Hall by Anne Bronte, one of the Bronte sisters. Some people have called this a feminist novel. Mm-hmm. Why does Adelaide love this book so much?
Well, I wanted to, so you know, you see books sometimes where there'll mm-hmm. be like the character in the book is reading another book, and it's often a book that in some way speaks to the larger ideas of the book you're reading. That novel, by the least known Bronte, right, mm-hmm. Is very much one of the central ideas is it's about a woman who leaves an abusive husband and makes her own life. And I felt like that would be the kind of thing that Adelaide, it would ring a bell in her because in her own life, her mother's telling her a woman is a mule. She's living on a family farm where they're sort of like walled in by their family secret. And essentially she knows she's just being trained to take over this responsibility. And so if her family at night would read a book about a woman who flees the burden of the people around her, she would be like, yeah, I like that. I like that a lot.
In the book, you get the sense of how difficult daily life was, just how harsh the conditions were. People were starving, people were freezing, trying to make it through the winter. When you did your research, what were some of the challenges specifically for female homesteaders?
Well, I mean, I think in some way, the at least in the stuff that I was reading, it was particularly in that book, it went less into the, well, maybe the biggest challenge was perhaps being able to find people you could trust, right? Everyone was facing the hardships of that landscape, but the but then the secondary question was like, sure, your neighbor might show up to help you when the roof caves in or whatever, but could you trust your neighbor to leave afterward, right? And so what you did find in the history was that the lone women often banded together, right? And that they were each other's best comfort. And that rang true to me just because, I mean, like one of the inspirations for the book certainly was my own wife, who has a number of friends who all serve different purposes, and she serves a different purpose in their lives, and they are each other's greatest support system in a way that they certainly don't ever go to, if they have male partners, to their male partners. And on the other side of things, as the as a man, I have one best friend, and he lives out in Portland. And we talk on the phone sometimes, but that's it. And so I really was so amazed and impressed by the idea of that kind of social network and the ways that one, they could support each other. And I, it just seemed, to my mind, like such a gift to have that.
Ooh, it makes the last like three pages of the book feel all like, tingly, you know, thinking about it. We asked our readers what homesteading skills they thought they had. Someone said, I knit and I'm militant about food waste. Another said, I'm a MacGyver kind of guy. Nice. Our producer, Kate, said I could probably run away from bears very quickly. what skill do you think you have? How would you have survived?
That's hard. I got to say, like, even now, sometimes we, my wife will say, like, let's go camping. And I immediately am looking for the glamping version of that. Like, I am not the, I am the one who's like, there's got to be a hotel somewhere in Montana. So I would die is essentially the truth.
I love the name of the Mudges. The Mudges who end this, enter this story. They first we think, oh, it's these four blind boys and their mother, and they're trying to make their way across, and we learn that they are just grifters and hugely problematic.
Yes.
First of all, how'd you come up with the name Mudge?
Well, so it was my that was my revenge on some neighbors who my mother really hated. And it's not their exact name, but it's super close. And they were terrible to my mom. That's my perspective as a loving son. Maybe she was terrible to them. I don't know. But they didn't. Their kids didn't write a book. So I just wanted to sort of spit on their name in a book. And so I gave it to the worst people, or some of the worst people in the book. But I also just thought the name, the Mudges, it just sounded so like... Don't mess with the Mudges.
And this rhymes with grudge.
And grudge, yes, for sure.
And Mudges
for sure.
Never forget.
That's right.
You're listening to my conversation with author Victor Laval about his novel, Lone Women, from our May Get Lit with All of It book club event. We'll have more with Victor and some questions from our audience after a quick break. This is All of It. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We continue my conversation with author Victor Laval about his gripping new novel, Lone Women. Victor joined us for our in-person Get Lit with All of It book club event, and thanks to our partners at the New York Public Library, 1,751 of you were able to check out a copy to read along with us this month. As always, our audience had some great questions for Victor, so you'll hear some of those in just a minute. But first, more of my conversation about Lone Women with Victor Laval. All right. So one of the things I mentioned to you earlier when we were talking back in the back, I said, wait, Victor, is there anything you want to really talk about? And he said, usually I can't spoil the novel. But since everybody's read it, we get to talk about the back half of the book, which is exciting. So the steamer trunk. How did you decide how long to keep us in the dark about what was in the steamer trunk or who was in the steamer trunk?
Yeah, that I think that just I tried it like there was earlier drafts where almost immediately, like on the ship when they're going, it like pops open and Elizabeth eats a sailor kind of thing. But it felt too like cheesy horror movie, you know, like there's a creep show. There's a movie from the 80s called Creep Show, and there's one of the stories in there is called the box, and there's a thing in a box, and it's left under some stairs, and it just starts eating people. And I love that one, but it's meant to be pulpy, kind of silly. So I said, well, let's not do that. And then I said, like, all right, well, she's not going to jump out right away, then maybe there's some pleasure in not revealing it. And then I just tried to see, like, how long could I not reveal it without it starting to be like, I hate this guy, you know? Because there was another time when I thought, like, what if you don't find out till, like, the end of the book? And that would have been like, I'm going to hit him. Yeah. You know, so it was really trial and error.
So Elizabeth is scaly and dragony and sometimes deadly. Did you have a picture of what Elizabeth looked like?
I did. Originally, I don't know if people would remember this, but in the 80s, there was a TV show called Land of the Lost with the Sleestaks. And originally, she kind of in my head looked. Who are they? They're like lizard people. And if you ever look them up, the makeup actually looks amazing for the time. But I imagined her a little bit on the head like that, like Sleestak-ish. But then I thought, like, well, but we've seen Sleestaks, so I can't do that. And then I also wanted her to fly. And then our kids, especially our older son, loves dragons. Just loves it. And now our younger son as well. And so dragons are always sort of in the house. They're always drawing dragons and all this. And I thought about this idea of like, well, to them, if they saw a dragon, it would be so much better than everything else life could offer. So, but of course, if I saw a dragon, I think I would be horrified and run away. And so I thought, oh, that's a kind of creature or body that your perspective determines whether it's considered something good or something bad. And each of us will bring a different thing to it. And in that way, I thought, like, oh, maybe that's interesting. So she's almost dinosaur-like, dragon-like. And we will get to see different people feeling differently about her when they see her.
We realize that Elizabeth may not be the only Elizabeth-like creature out there, but we don't really know the origin story. Do you know it? Do you have a backstory that?
So you know,
these creatures?
I guess what I will say is like, my family, we have a number of people in the family who deal with varying degrees, some really severe, of what we might call mental illness or neurodivergence, right? It's one of my obsessions, I think, is the question of like, why do some people come out one way and why do other people come out this other way? And there is no answer to that thing. There is conjecture, there's this, there's that. But it is one of the great mysteries of certainly my life when I look at my family, is the gamble of that thing, right? And so for me, as much as it is always unsatisfying to people, the answer is that happens sometimes. And this is how people come out. And certainly the point by the end of the story is, and it's only one's perspective that presumes that means it is a curse. Other people will see that and say it's a blessing. And then there's a third option that says like, oh, it's just run of the mill. It's just how they came out, you know? And that was my feeling of like how much I wanted to go, as opposed to like you find out 500 years ago, dragon people came to Earth from Venus or something. You know, I felt like that's the surefire way for me to make this too goofy. That's to my mind, it was just a matter of like, it's just an accident of birth.
How did you find Elizabeth's voice?
That was actually my editor, Chris Jackson. He was her chapters originally were written just like everyone else's. And his point was like, that's boring, number one. But number two, it doesn't make sense. He was saying like, for someone who has lived so differently and who thinks so differently and who's in such a different sort of experience, why would they just come out exactly the same? Might there be some way that they see the world a little differently? And could you teach us that through how we just scan their parts on the page? And I thought like, all right, so then maybe this is one of the moments where I get to give the heartbreaking insight that in fact Elizabeth is a complex thinking being with insight and beauty. And to my mind, that only makes it more horrifying that that's how her family treated her, mm-hmm. because this is who was inside. And so I wanted it to feel poetic and beautiful, and that hopefully it would only make your heart break more, mm-hmm. for her having lived 31 years treated like something inhuman or something monstrous.
What did you want to explore about violence in this book? Because things get pretty violent.
Things get pretty violent, yeah. I mean, I mean, the first thing is, like, as I was reading those newspaper accounts, what was regularly made clear was how absolutely violent this world was. You know, like, there's a part, a portion of the way through where I list a few deaths. A child walks out of the house in the middle of a snowstorm and gets lost in the snow and essentially bleeds to death from the cold out there. A woman drinks, I forget exactly what it was now, I'm blanking on the exact thing she drinks. And the question is, did she try to kill herself, or did she just in the middle of the night mistakenly drink this thing? It was basically like drinking acid. Mm. And there was constant stuff like that happening. So that boy dying was a real news story.
Wow.
The woman drinking that poison and, like, basically bubbling her insides was a real story. And the more I picked up, the more I was just like, oof. Mm. I actually can't write how rough this place is. So in a weird way, I totally understand that it's a violent book. And yet when I finished it, I was just like, I really held back compared to how things were, you know. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Let's take some audience questions.
I've read all your books, most of them several times, and what I feel about them is they're very cinematic. And so I guess my question is, do you see your books as films? And if so, what director, Jordan Peele, would you work with? Jordan Peele for your movie.
Jordan Peele.
Well, for some reason, I'm thinking Jordan Peele. Certainly, number one, thank you for reading all of them multiple times. Two, I do think there's a visual component. Like, I don't think of them as films, certainly, but I do try to. I'm a very visual learner and thinker, so I do think I default to trying to paint visual pictures as well as, you know, spending time inside characters' heads and all the rest. And so I hope that that comes across so that you can actually, like, you can really feel like you're there and you can see these things and all the rest. And, you know, if I believed Jordan Peele would ever direct something he didn't write, then I would love it. I would be thrilled, yes. So from your mouth.
We put it out in the universe.
To the, yes, that's right, that's right.
And there we go in the back.
Hi. Well, thank you for this. Was a great conversation. I wanted to know, you spoke a little bit about what was the inspiration for setting up in Montana and what led you to write this story. Given that a lot of your writing up until now has often, or a lot of writing that you've done has been in New York, or as you mentioned, a version of Oakland, what was the process of writing in a place that might have been, at the very least initially, foreign, like, and kind of how did you work through those challenges beyond the research of the Gazette?
Well, I actually, the funny thing is, the Gazette was like the greatest gift for that. I got inspiration from, I think, is her name Lauren Hillenbrand, the mm-hmm. writer of Seabiscuit. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing a piece on her talking about, she has, I think, an autoimmune issue that doesn't allow her to leave her home terribly much and go do research in the places she goes to. So she's the one who talked about, like, what I do is I buy all the newspapers mm-hmm. of that era and of that time, and I just read them. And I don't read them just for the news. I read what are the advertisements? Like, what are people buying these days? I read the death notices. Like, has there been a spate of children dying? Have there been, was there an illness that was local that maybe doesn't make the history books? So in fact, like, reading the newspaper was, in fact, the greatest way for me to, short of, like I said, I'm married with two kids, so I was not picking up and moving to Montana anytime soon. Certainly, my family did not want to go with me there, and I was not going to be leaving my wife alone with the two kids. I think that was clear. I'm promising you. So So this was the next best thing. And so, but reading those papers, it was fascinating to see over the span of like 5, 6, 7 years, you really do get a sense of like when the just, you can even see it like right around 1916 is right when the Dust Bowl, everything that's going to create the Dust Bowl is just starting. Uh-huh. But 1915, 1914, they're like, this is the land of milk and honey.
Wow.
There's rain plentiful. The snows mm-hmm. are good, blah, blah, blah. And you can just see the moment when everything tilts. And then all of a sudden, everything gets more desperate and all the rest. And so that really was the heart of that research, just reading that and starting to feel like I was really getting to know these folks on a minute level.
That was my conversation with author Victor Laval from our May Get Lit with All of It book club event. We spent the month reading his novel, Lone Women.